Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is To Build a Fire.
This hour, we're hearing stories of survival, ingenuity, and last-ditch efforts.
Longtime Alaskan Chris Lira will take us back to her early years and to a house-sitting gig that changed everything.
When I was but a youth of about 20, I dropped out of college because I already knew everything. I moved back to Portland, Oregon, and got a job and moved back in with my parents, much to my dismay. So when my employers asked me to house sit for them over the Christmas holidays, I jumped at the chance. My brother and sister-in-law came down from Seattle to spend Christmas with my parents and myself. So they stayed with me at my employer's house. But we had all been over at my parents' for Christmas Eve festivities, and we left late, and my brother and sister-in-law had a stop to make along the way home, so they were going to be about 15, 20 minutes behind me. So I got back to my employer's house alone, and I'm rummaging through my purse for my keys, and I can hear the dog inside, and she's just barking and barking. She's just barking up a storm. And I'm thinking, man, she really has to go to the bathroom. So I'm unlocking the door, and I get it unlocked, and I'm pushing and pushing. I can't get it open. It's stuck in the jam or something. I don't know what's going on. So I'm looking at the door, and all of a sudden it opens all on its own, and the dog whooshes past me and off into the night. And I'm thinking, she really did have to go to the bathroom. And I turn in to go into the house, and there's a guy standing there. And it's dark. And I'm thinking, oh, it must be the neighbor, of course. So I introduce myself. I say, hi, I'm Chris. I'm the house sitter. And the guy grabs me and he pulls me inside. And I'm tripping over the television and the stereo equipment. There's a record player. And all this stuff piled up by the front door. And I'm thinking, I don't think this guy is the neighbor. And I start screaming, and he clamps his hand over my mouth, and I bite down really hard on his hand. And now he's yelping, and I'm screaming, and I'm doing all my karate moves, and I'm kicking. And another guy comes up from downstairs, and he's got a can of something in his hands, and he rips off my glasses, and he starts spraying my eyes with this can. And now my entire focus is right here. In my eyes, they are on fire. They are burning. I swear to you, there were flames shooting out of them. And I'm crying, and the robbers take this opportunity to lay me down on the floor. One of them holds me down. The other one goes and gets the sheets off the bed, and he rips up the sheets, and they tie me up. They bind me hands and feet. And now the downstairs robber can go back to his robbery duties. And the upstairs robber stays with me, and he goes and gets a washcloth and gets it wet. I'm still whining and crying and complaining about my eyes. So he lays it across my eyes, and he's like sponging out my eyes. And I'm feeling a little better now. And I said, what did you spray in my eyes? And he says, it's turpentine. It stings like a son of a gun, but there's no permanent damage. So now I'm feeling better. I'm not going to be blind forever, just temporarily. And I'm kind of feeling kind of guilty now because I really did bite his hand really hard. And so I apologize for biting his hand. And he says, well, you know, it's just kind of an occupational hazard. These things happen. And he goes off to finish up his robbery duties and leaves me there on the floor with a little washcloth over my eyes. So I'm laying there, and I'm thinking about that guy coming upstairs with just a can of turpentine in his hands. That's his only weapon. And I'm thinking, you know, that's pretty amazing. And I ask the guy, I say, you guys don't have any guns, do you? And he says, yes, we do. That ends the chit-chat portion of the robbery. And so I'm now lying there silent. And I hear my brother's car on the hill. Oh, yeah, my brother. So I tell the guy, hey, that's my brother's car. I know it's a Saab 99E. It's got a fuel injection engine. It sounds a little bit different. I know that's his car. I don't care what you guys take, but just please don't be here when he gets here. Apparently, they think that's a good idea, too. I hear footsteps outside. Zoom! The car goes up the hill just before Tom and Barb pull into the driveway. So I'm saved. The police are called. They come. They don't find any fingerprints, no footprints. They find where the guys got in very easily by just pushing up a window. So there's no damage to the house. There's no damage to me. I don't have a bruise or a scratch on me, nothing. The turpentine is fading away. I can see now. So the police tell me how lucky I am that these guys were such professionals. And they tell me a few things that could have happened if they hadn't been such pros. And off they go. And now I'm feeling guilty again. My employers entrusted me with their home, and it got robbed. And my brother looks at me, and he says, are you serious? You stopped the robbery. Here's all this stuff right here. They didn't get anything, and the house hasn't been damaged. I'm like, yeah, that's right. I'm the hero of this story. That's right. And then the dog comes back, and when you think about it, really, the dog was a hero, too. She tried to tell me what was going on. I just didn't understand what she was saying. So we're a couple of heroes, yeah. So fast forward a couple of days. The holidays are over. My brother and sister-in-law have gone back to Seattle. And I'm alone in the house with the dog. The heroes are huddled by the fire because Portland has had one of its famous ice storms. 2 inches of ice cover everything. Power lines have come down. Thousands of people are without power, including me, in the house where I'm house-sitting. So we're huddled up next to the fire. And now I realize what those guys really did steal. They stole my sense of security. Because before the robbery, I would have laughed if you'd said anything like that could happen to me. Don't be ridiculous. During the robbery, there was a moment of panic, but basically, I was pretty calm. Those guys really were pros. But now we're after the robbery. I know what can happen. I know it can happen easily. And I've got the wind and the tree branches breaking off from the weight of the ice, and there's all kinds of noises outside. I've got nothing to distract me. There's no television, no radio to cover up some of those noises. It's just me and the dog by the fire in the dark, waiting for the next person to break in. And it could be a robber or a rapist or a killer. A robber, a rapist, a killer. Oh, my. 3 days of this, sitting by the fire in the dark, huddled up, shivering from fear and from cold. And it was terrifying. Those were the worst 3 days of my life. It was horrible. But eventually, my employers did come home. They sent me back home to my parents' house, where I never complained about living again. I survived, and I lived to tell the tale.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is To Build a Fire, stories of survival, ingenuity, and last-ditch efforts.
Now we'll hear from Jen Loofborough, who is originally from Canada, where she first fell in love with the outdoors. Now an Alaskan, the wild outdoors still inspire her, even after this experience she's about to share.
Here's Jen Loofborough on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
It is an overcast morning in southeast Alaska. We look through fog and dense cloud-covered skies as we hike up a shale-covered scramble between two snow chutes of spring corn snow. We are 4,000 feet up and about a 4-hour hike in from the Sheep Creek trailhead in Juneau. Our friend Brandon is up above me, where I can't see him, and I'm with my boyfriend Hale and our other friend Josh. Through the thick fog, I hear Brandon yell, "Rock!" I hear the crash and tumble of rock, and I look up to see a large piece of shale split into two and one piece become airborne above my head. "Ah!" I scream as I throw my hands up to cover my head, try to run to the side, and duck towards the mountain. I feel a sharp, heavy blow to the head, and I'm knocked off my feet. I'm sliding down the rock slope. I need to stop because I do not want to hit the snow below the snow slope and fall deep into the valley, maybe to my death. I dig my heels in, I dig my hands in, and I stop myself from sliding. I feel really battered. I check my body over. I feel my head, there's blood in my hair, and a cut behind my ear. It'll probably be okay. I look down at my right hand, which probably took the brunt of the blow, and I don't understand. I see my fingers, I see the back of my hand, I see the jagged edge of some white, pasty flesh, and white and brown. And I start thinking, what's my life gonna be like? Am I gonna survive this? I scream, I cut off my thumb! Ah! It's dangling from a small flap of skin. I can see the bone, it's broken below the second joint, cut right through, and muscles and tendons hanging out. I cradle the thumb in my hand and roll onto my elbows and crawl over to the side of the rocks to where the snow is. Meanwhile, Hale, Josh, Brandon are coordinating a rescue effort. I get my hand into the snow, cover my hand, and it's so painful. I'm freezing my fingers, but I figure it's worth it if I'm gonna save my thumb. I pick up my thumb and align it with the rest of my hand and pack snow on top of that. I watch the snow become saturated with this pink-orange liquid and think, how much blood can you lose? Am I actually gonna die? They put thumbs back on in the movies. Maybe they can put this one back on if we can save it. I hear from Hale and Josh and Brandon that Brandon has hiked up to the highest point above us with his mom's cell phone, which he brought at the last second because it was 2006 and we didn't all have cell phones. He got through to 911 and they sent a helicopter, but they couldn't find us. It was an extremely low, dense cloud cover, and they didn't know where we were. He somehow got through to the flight seeing company in Juneau, and they sent a helicopter. They knew the area we were in. The plan was hatched that if we could get me to where the power line came over that ridge, that they could probably find us, and we could get off this mountain and me to medical safety. We emptied the stuff out of my little backpack, loaded it up with snow. I put my hand and my thumb in my little backpack with all the snow and cradled it under my arm like a baby. Our friend Josh kicked steps into the snow while Hale walked behind me, making sure I didn't slip, and we made the 2-mile journey to where the power line came over that ridge. When we got there, we could hear the helicopter. Then we could see it, and we saw it land somewhere off in the distance. We made our way to the helicopter. The paramedic got to me, and I just said to him, "What time is it? I need to know what time it is. I need to call my parents in Canada and get the health insurance information." He said, "It's 10:30. I said, "Okay, we'll call him as soon as we get to the hospital." The helicopter took me off the mountain. An ambulance ride took me to the hospital. Hale ran down the mountain and met me at the hospital in what seemed like the exact same time. They told me that they weren't going to clean the wound, that they didn't want to risk doing any further damage to the injury, and that the only surgeon that can do replantations of thumbs was on vacation. I got on the phone with my parents and said, "Mom, I hurt my hand, it's okay, I just need the health insurance information, everything's fine, I'll tell you about it later." The hospital coordinated the rescue effort and that a jet would be sent from somewhere else in Alaska to come to Juneau to get me and take me either to Anchorage or Vancouver, Canada. Then that jet was dispatched, it was rerouted, and they sent a different jet from Ketchikan, Alaska because it would be more economical for health insurance. The only other problem being is that insurance didn't cover the ride from the hospital to the airport. So the paramedics in the Bartlett Regional Hospital, out of the kindness of their own hearts and bending the rules, delivered me to the airport to make that plane. The small medevac jet had room for a pilot, me on a gurney, one paramedic, and Hale. And we flew directly to Vancouver, no customs clearance. And on the tarmac, I get loaded right into an ambulance. I'm thinking things might be okay, but all the while people are telling me, you know, it's a ticking time clock on how long a thumb can be detached from the body and be saved. We're talking about phantom pain, and I think I can still feel my thumb. And I remember the Ketchikan paramedics telling the ambulance drivers in Canada, "Put on the siren, this is an emergency." We get to Vancouver General Hospital and I meet the surgeon, the one surgeon that will have the best chance at saving my thumb. He tells me that the surgery will be anywhere from 1 to 6 hours. He can't have a proper look at it until we get into the operating room because he too does not want to risk doing any further damage. He shows me his hand and says that he doesn't have full function of his thumb and he is a microvascular surgeon. 3 hours later, I'm out of surgery. I wake up, and it's about midnight. I have family all around me, and an overwhelming feeling that it's going to be a long and delicate road to recovery, but that probably everything will be okay. And it is. I went on to regain some feeling, fairly decent mobility. I have it. And I am proud of my story. If you want, you can come visit me in the lobby at intermission and check out the scar. It's pretty amazing what the human body can do with modern medicine and a big community of people.
That was Jen Loofborough, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans.
This next story takes place in the cold, winter waters of Kachemak Bay.
Kent Hina was born and raised in Hawaii. He became a pilot, but eventually landed in Alaska as a fisherman. Let's hear about his experience.
Homer, Alaska, the halibut fishing capital of the world. A quaint little village, quaint little drinking village with a fishing problem. Well, that's what I went there for. Not the drinking, the fishing. I left a 25-year career flying airplanes for a living to start my own halibut fishing business in Homer. It was my second season. It was a week away from the annual Winter King Salmon Tournament. That morning, a storm raged outside my window. Then all of a sudden, it stopped. Flat calm. The storm didn't have to stop, but it did. Something was drawing me down to the harbor to work on my boat. I didn't have to leave my house, but I did. I did about an hour of boat chores. I was about ready to lock my boat up, head back home, when something told me I should go get gas. I didn't need any gas. My tanks were pretty full, but I left my slip anyway. I motored over to the field dock, and it was closed. Remember, it was winter. It was a Sunday. The field dock's not open on Sunday in winter. So I thought about turning around and going back to my boat slip. But I had this nagging feeling again that I needed to go do something else. Something told me to leave the harbor. I didn't really need to leave the harbor. I had absolutely no reason to leave the harbor. But I did. Well, when I got to the mouth of the harbor, I had to make another decision. Do I turn left and go up Kachemak Bay, or do I turn right and go out to Cook Inlet? Well, I made the decision to go left, or did fate make that decision for me? As soon as I left the mouth of the harbor, I could see a boat a few miles ahead of me. I cross-checked his position with my GPS map, and he was right on top of one of my favorite fishing spots in the back bay. Now, you don't know me very well, but I'm pretty nosy. My first reaction was to run up there and see if he caught anything. I could have done that, but I didn't. I just started ambling along, and my meandering eventually led me a little closer to the boat. I was trying not to get too close, but then my eye caught something else, a debris field. Floating bottles of water, clothing, a cooler full of food. I'm like, woohoo, finders keepers, right? So, like a trail of breadcrumbs, I kept following it, picking up things along the way. I didn't need any of this junk, but I picked it up anyway. It got me closer to the boat. Suddenly, I was within binocular range. I picked up my binos, put them up there, started scoping them out. I couldn't really tell what they were doing. It looked like there's one guy standing there jigging, and another one kind of hunkered over, you know, just bait fishing. I couldn't even tell if they caught anything. So being nosy, and being that much closer to the boat now, I said, what the heck? I'll just run up there and see if they caught anything. So I just motored along, headed up towards this boat. As he got closer and he came into focus, I realized what it was, and my blood ran cold. It was four people and a large yellow lab on the bottom of a capsized boat. We all know, living in Alaska, that cold winter water can kill a man in minutes. I raced towards the boat at flank speed. I got them all on board. Raced towards them at flank speed. As I headed towards the boat, I grabbed the microphone from my marine radio. I switched over to the emergency frequency. I keyed the microphone, and I shouted, "Mayday, mayday, mayday." I got all the people in the boat and the dog, got them into the warm wheelhouse, started heading back to the harbor. I turned to them, "What happened?" These were four friends who were on a backcountry weekend ski trip at the head of the bay in Homer. They were coming back that morning in the storm before the flat calm lured me out of my home, into the harbor, out of my boat slip, out of the harbor, into a debris field up Kachemak Bay and alongside their doomed vessel. They explained to me that their cell phones all died when they went in the water, their survival equipment was trapped under the boat, and what I had mistaken for jigging was one of these guys standing up trying to flag me down, and the other three kneeling around him, supporting him while he tried to flag me down. They did that for 4 hours before this incredible series of left or right decisions led me to the same spot on the planet as them. I told them that it wasn't their day to die. I told them that one of them was destined to do something great and that they should be thankful for their lives. And thank God every man, woman, and dog that was on that boat was accounted for. We returned to the harbor and said our goodbyes. Exactly 1 year later, my phone rang. I said, "Hello?" The voice on the other end of the line said, "Happy anniversary. Thanks for saving my life." One of the survivors of that incident is now an emergency room physician saving other lives. That event changed my life. Up to that point in time, I didn't have a whole lot of, credence in the phrase, "Everything happens for a reason." Well, apparently it does. Fast forward a few years. New federal regulations forced me out of the fishing business. Now what am I going to do? Well, something in Anchorage was calling me. Anchorage was calling me to move here. So I did. I got a job flying airplanes for a living again. I even teach other pilots how to fly the Queen of the Skies, the 747. I wonder what my next reason is.
Thanks to Kent Heine for sharing that story. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our next true story is told by Amy Pettit. This hour, we're hearing stories of survival, ingenuity, and last-ditch efforts.
Amy's story is one that's all too relatable. It's a story of grieving for a loved one and the effort to survive that grief.
It's October of 2009, and I am a happily married 29-year-old mother of a beautiful toddler with my second child on the way. I've just been down in Southeast Alaska on a business trip where I've experienced the worst flight of my life. I was on the Milk Run, and it was one of those short flights, like 12 minutes long, and the turbulence was so bad, I threw up 7 times. I wasn't the only person puking on the plane. It was awful. Everyone was puking. When I landed in Anchorage, I did what everyone who experiences something awful does, and I called my mom. And I whined, and I complained to her, and she comforted me and told me how proud of me she was. And then she quickly turned the subject to her most favorite thing to talk about, which was her grandchildren, my babies. And she told me how excited she was to see me the next month when we would be visiting her for Thanksgiving. And we had a great conversation like we did every day. And I ended the call happy and not so upset about that flight. The next morning started like any other day. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, the toddler crawled into bed with her dad and I. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, I got my husband up and out the door to his job with his coffee and lunch. It's about 10 o'clock that morning when all of the details become so very clear to me. My father-in-law comes in my office and he closes the door behind him. He looks at me and looks down at his hands and then looks back at me and says, "Amy, I don't know how to say this to you, so I'm just gonna say it. Your mom died." I look at him and I say, "What?" And he repeats himself. And I say, "Do you mean your mom? Because your mom is in her 80s, and your mom has had multiple cancers, and your mom has Lyme disease. But my mom is only 60, and my mom is fine. She's in perfect health, and I just saw her last month, and I just talked to her on the phone yesterday. You don't mean my mom." And he says, "Amy, your dad called me because he didn't want you to hear the news alone. And I'm so sorry, but she had a heart attack at work this morning, and the ambulance didn't get there in time. She's gone." I scream, and I begin yelling over and over again, "No, not my mom. Not my mom. Not my mom." You see, because my mom is the kind of mom that all of us deserve to have. She's unconditional love and unconditional support, and she's always there for me. And I'm just a baby myself, and I'm pregnant, and all she wanted to be was a grandmother, not my mom. We fly to Oregon that night, and in the drive south from Portland, I somehow fall asleep. And I dream that we're just going home to my hometown for Thanksgiving. It's all okay. But I wake up and I realize that that's not the case. And I lose it all over again in the car. And suddenly I hear my mom's voice. It's like she's in the car with us. And she says, "Amy Renee, don't you dare name that baby after me." And I'm thinking, "What, mom?" Like, over the course of the next 2 weeks, I do all of the things that you do when your loved one dies. I plan the service, and I write the obituary, and I order the flowers, and I do all the things. And I don't know how I do any of it, because all I want to do is lay down and go to sleep and never wake up again. And I want to drink a glass. I want to drink a bottle of wine, and I want to smoke a joint. I just want to relax, but I can't because I'm pregnant. And after a couple of days, I realized that I haven't felt the baby move. And this is not okay because I'm 5.5 months pregnant. And I tell my husband, and he calls the midwife, and she says, "Amy, that baby is feeling everything that you're feeling. And she's hunkered down and she's scared, just as scared as you are. And you've got to keep it together, Amy, because you're all she has. And I know how hard this must be, but you have to be a good mom because she needs you. That baby needs you." 4 months later, after 26 hours of labor, our second daughter is born 2 weeks early on my mom's birthday. And everyone raves about what a miracle that is and what a blessing. And obviously my mom must have been part of it. But it's also a very stark and poignant reminder that my mom's not there. And I need her to be there with me. And no, we don't name her after my mom because she told me not to. So we don't. A few weeks later, we're driving in the car and an ambulance comes up behind me. And I pull over, like I'm legally bound to do. And the lights and the sirens just send me into a full-on meltdown. And I'm gasping for air, and I can't. I can't breathe, and there's snot and tears, and my toddler says from the back seat, "Mommy, what's wrong?" And I say to her, "Oh, Abby, it's just that if only that ambulance had made it in time, you know? And I just hope that it makes it wherever it's going in time." And she reaches into the car seat next to her, and she grabs her baby sister's hand, and she says, "Mommy, real life is hard."
That was Amy Pettit, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Thanks to Amy for that heartfelt story. Just a quick reminder that all the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud.
Our next storyteller lives in Sitka and moved to Alaska just 5 months ago. He's a fast-talking East Coaster who is making the most of his time here. Here's Rafi Bildner.
So as was just mentioned, I'm relatively new to Alaska. Classic tale of the East Coast boy comes out to Alaska just after graduating college and hopes for dreams in the frontier. For me, those dreams have been working in politics around the state. So I've mostly spent my time in front of a computer, or on the phone, or in offices. So haven't gone outside as much as I would have liked. So my philosophy here has been, if someone asks me to go on a trip or an adventure comes my way, I've just been saying yes. If there's an opportunity, I just want to get out there. That led to me being on a sport fishing trip, actually out of Homer, way out in the Cook Inlet, about 40 miles out, with kind of a unique group of guys, mostly people I really didn't know. There was Scott, the boat owner, who was this really kind of self-made Alaskan man, really hates the government, big anti-government fan, just absolutely hates bureaucracy. He owns a construction company. His employee Dustin just got back from a trip from working on the slope for a long time. Dustin, big burly guy, was wearing these steel boots that were huge, some of the biggest I've ever seen in my life. I don't know why I needed them on this sunny August day. Dustin, big Donald Trump fan, told me several times throughout the day that Donald Trump, quote, epitomized what it means to be a man. particularly relevant now. And then there was kind of a vague acquaintance of mine on the boat and his brother-in-law, so kind of an interesting group. Throughout the day, there were things that were kind of irking me, things that were making me feel a little uncomfortable. For one, they were kept talking about how East Coasters don't know any common sense, that city people don't know how to really take care of themselves, so they're kind of prodding me with that. They really couldn't stand that I was a vegetarian. They had buckets and buckets, like buckets of fried chicken on this boat, and were just like waving the fried chicken in my face at some points and telling me that's not evolutionarily possible to be a vegetarian. I'm living proof that it is. They were kept going way over their rockfish fishing limit. At one point, we were motoring back, there were just rockfish, small rockfish floating like balloons all over the boat, and the kind of peace-loving, hippy-dippy vegetarian that I am, the most common t-shirt I wear has kale across the chest, that was quite hard to take in. Anyway, kind of a weird day, but we're motoring back towards Homer, and I'm thinking that things are relaxing a little bit. I'm taking an Instagram of the sun setting over the Alaska Range, obviously in secret. They would hate it if they knew I was taking an Instagram. I'm opening the pages of my new book on sustainable agriculture, starting to relax. And then I hear pop, 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 boom, and the engine just cuts out. We're at the junction, kind of the Kachemak Bay and Cook Inlet, this just bathtub of tidal currents and weird tides and ocean movements. And immediately, these guys start to kind of like figure out what's going on. They're like looking into fuel tanks. I knew there was a bad sign when Scott, the owner of the boat, tries prying open the back fuel tank, and it looked like it hadn't been opened in months, if not years. It becomes clear to me that there's just no fuel left. And then after about this initial 10, 15-minute period passes, two of the guys start just filleting fish, like, oh, the boat's adrift, might as well just fillet fish. And then the other two guys continue to tinker with fuel lines and filters and pumps and try to find a problem that just doesn't exist. The problem is we're out of gas. At one point, I remember seeing one of the guys just banging on the back of the boat, if like that's going to help it turn on. So I realize quite, I ask, Scott, is there anything I can do to get us out of the situation? He says, oh, no, you know, just kind of chill out, you know, we're fine, we'll just drift out here. He didn't have enough, he basically had no anchor line on the boat, too, I found out at that moment. So he said, you know, well, you know, why don't you just go down, there's sleeping bags down below, we'll probably boat, will find us in the morning, and, because it was getting dark at this point, and, you know, we're fine, and please, whatever you do, just don't tell anyone what's going on, don't tell the government, don't get the Coast Guard involved, that's the worst thing to happen. When he said that, my personality is such that I was like, oh my gosh, I need to tell everyone I know what's going on. So I get to this like kind of corner of the boat off the bow and like start launching this covert rescue operation. I huddle under my hoodie, my jacket, and start just texting, calling, pinging, Facebook messaging anyone I could possibly think of. I've only been in the state for 2 months, but I'm like telling everyone, oh my God, I'm here. I knew if I was gonna go down, I at least wanted people to know where I was. I didn't want the last people to know what was going on to be these anti-government people on the boat with me. Through a series, I mean, I told my boss's friends, just everyone. I'm sending Find My Friend alerts to my parents, my poor, loving, really, really great parents out on the East Coast who are freaking out. And then through a series of events, I'm connected to the harbor master in the town of Seldovia, a small village of Seldovia, about 5 miles from where we are. And I mean, keep in mind, I'm like trying to tell them what's going on, and I'm like going off of an iPhone app that's telling me our coordinates. I'm like, I remember Googling, you know, what is the fuel economy of this particular Yamaha engine? I'm like trying to come up with answers for them. And they say, oh, we think we can find some guys to come help you out. A little while later, I get notification that the harbor master has found you guys to bring us fuel out. And then, basically an hour and a half or so later, I hear a crackle on the radio, and it's clear that there are people coming to get us. And these guys get on the radio and say, hey, is there a distress vessel out there to the west of Seldovia? We're coming to get you. And I get on, and I ask them what their vessel name is. And they say, oh, yeah, we're MV Blow Up Doll, and we'll be there as soon as we can. Hour and 45 minutes later, it's about like 11:30-ish at night. Luckily, the weather was good, so we hadn't moved too much. There's like an anchor that's kind of like dangling off the boat. It's just symbolic. I hear out of the darkness of the night this little dinky motor, and all of a sudden, a little inflatable raft appears next to our boat. And it contains a tiny little engine, a very little amount of fuel, and the two town drunks who have come to get us. And the first thing I heard them saying was they were freaking out about it. They were like, oh my God, this boat is so much bigger than we thought it would be. I can't believe this. And then they started complaining about how they were missing the last hour of the bar being open. They were pretty plastered, and they gave us just a little bit of fuel to get us basically 15 minutes more towards Seldovia. The boat stops, that's it. I mean, in that moment, I had to make a decision. Do I stay on this boat? Scott, the owner of the boat, was saying he's gonna stay on the boat no matter what. You just, if anything, you go down with your vessel, you don't leave it. I obviously decided to leave the vessel, and it seemed like the best decision at the time. Get in this little inflatable raft with two drunk dudes and motor 45 minutes to Seldovia, and I do that, and eventually we convince Scott to do the same, so everyone leaves the boat. I remember looking at the stars above as we're motoring back and feeling how calm I was then at that moment, and how wonderful it was that we were going to be okay. And meanwhile, the two guys who are driving the boat are complaining about the bar. Dustin and Scott are complaining that we left the boat, and I'm feeling pretty peaceful. We get into town. Obviously, they're very good friends with the bar owner. They're able to find us a room to crash for the night above the bar. The final memory of that weird, unique day is sleeping in this cozy inflatable mattress with Dustin, snuggling with him as he starts grumbling to me about why we shouldn't have left the boat. And all I do is look over at my phone, see all the pings and Facebook messages and all the memories of all the people I've called throughout the last few hours, and realize, I guess, it sometimes pays off to be that slightly neurotic East Coast boy.
That was Rafi Bildner on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Our theme for this show is To Build a Fire, stories of survival, ingenuity, and last-ditch efforts.
Our next story is pretty gruesome. If you are at all squeamish about human anatomy, you may want to sit this story out. Jonathan Bressler is a Chicagoan who has done some interesting things to make money to survive over the years. This is a story about one of them.
I was living in an apartment living in an apartment above an old mom-and-pop hardware store next to the expressway in Chicago. When it rained, water would seep in through the windows and pool next to the couch. My rent was only $450 a month, but I only had $300 to my name. So I turned to Craigslist. The title of the job posting was Tissue Procurement Technician. Now, I had no idea what a tissue procurement technician was, and the posting wasn't very informative, but it did say that a background in science and a knowledge of anatomy was needed. Now, I studied biology in college, and I'd taken a class in anatomy. Not that I remembered much of it, but I applied because I needed a job. 10 minutes into the phone interview, I still didn't understand what it was. So the woman on the other end said, what I like to call it is whole body disassembly. On the first day, they had me come in to show me what I'd be doing and to test my stomach. They brought a cadaver out from a freezer and put it onto the operating table. And as my coworker, Tracy, made the first cut, it occurred to me that the inside of a human looks a lot like the inside of a goat. I'd seen plenty of butchered livestock when I was in the Peace Corps, and so I used that image to draw up a wall between the gruesome scene in front of me and my more weak-stomached conscience. And I wasn't even the most sensitive person in that room. Tracy is probably the most tender-hearted person I have ever met. When a squirrel fell out of a tree in her backyard and broke its leg, she brought it inside and nursed it back to health all winter. It would steal her granola bars and drink her coffee. I thought it was disgusting, but she thought it was just the sweetest little soul. So that's what it would be, me and Tracy, returned Peace Corps volunteer and squirrel doctor, working together, ripping apart human bodies to make ends meet. I'm sure you're wondering what this was all for. Let's say you're a knee surgeon. The way you learn to do surgery is you practice on cadavers, but if you're just a knee surgeon, you've got no use for the feet or the head or the torso or the thumbs. So there are companies out there that separate those parts out and send them out to doctors to practice on. At any one moment, Joe Smith's head could be getting a nose job in LA while he's getting knee surgery in Boston and new hips in a nondescript building nestled among cornfields in the Midwest. Tracy and I, we were the ones who did the separating. A strange thought occurred to me on that first day, that this is not how we're put together, but it's how we come apart. On the second day, it was my turn to try, so Tracy gave me a scalpel and pointed at a spot in the middle of the cadaver's thigh for me to cut into. I recalled the strange sense of glee I'd felt years earlier in anatomy class when you'd tug on a tendon in a forearm and a finger would twitch, like a body was coming alive with a wink and saying, "That's the flexor digitorum superficialis." It felt like cheating, but this time I prayed that the body in front of me wouldn't twitch, wouldn't wink. The first time you cut apart a human body, you can't help but wonder if there's still someone in there. So I concentrated on a piece of meat right in front of me. It reminded me of a rare steak. The job completely ruined some foods for me. I hardly ever eat steak now, and when I do, I order it well done. And I know all you purists are scoffing, but when you're salivating over your bloody tenderloin, I'm trying to hold back memories of cutting into the thigh of someone's grandmother with a scalpel and going at her femur with a hacksaw. Water chestnuts. I used to love water chestnuts. But when you cut into the disc between a couple of lumbar vertebrae, the texture is eerily like chomping down on an order of Kung Pao chicken. See, the best way to cut apart a spine is to go in through the front, right behind the organs, because you don't have all these spinous processes protecting your spine. But before you do that, you've got to get all the organs out. And you can't go in there with a scalpel because you might cut into something. Cut into the stomach and all the gas being produced by the bacteria that used to help you with digestion and now is eating you from the inside out escapes and the most disgusting fart I've ever smelled. Cut into the colon and that last shit you never got to take spills out into your abdomen, and guess who gets to clean that up with medical-grade toilet paper? So we had to go in with our hands and separate the organs from the walls of the abdomen bit by bit. Some of these guys are 300 pounds. Have you ever been shoulders deep inside the blood, viscera, and feces of someone else's abdomen? It's awful. So once we got all the organs out, we cut into the water chestnuts between the vertebrae and cut around as much as possible. But even that wouldn't do the trick, so Tracy and I would have to flip the body over with its back facing the ceiling and then fold the torso backwards up onto the backs of the legs to a satisfying snap. And then there's Grandma's torso hanging from her hips by a thin bit of spinal cord, the way a baby tooth dangles from a child's mouth by a little bit of gums. When the new year came around, I resolved I'd quit. When I told Tracy, she called me back and begged me to stay until I started grad school. I mean, the job was absolutely terrible, but we were a team, and I certainly couldn't let her do it all alone. So I stayed just a little while longer. But every day, I came home exhausted. I mean, the physical labor of ripping apart a human body is hard enough, but then you've got to deal with the inevitable emotions that go with it. Kung Fu movies make it look easy to snap someone's neck, but in reality, pulling a head from a torso is like pulling a soul from the river Hades. And when the bloodlust cools, you realize you're cradling a human head in your hands, and you get to deal with that emotion. So every day, I'd pull into the parking lot behind the hardware store where I lived. I climb the stairs up to my apartment. I throw my scrubs right into the washer and go to take a hot shower, as I'd feel the warm water dripping down my neck and pooling at my feet. I'd hold my fingers to my neck, feel my pulse. I'd run my hands through my hair, grateful that I, for one, was alive. And even better, I could pay my rent.
That was Jonathan Bressler, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our final storyteller for this hour is Nicole Stemke. She says she's a recovering Midwesterner who has been living in Alaska for 12 years.
Here she is, sharing one of her adventures live on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So it was Solstice Weekend 2010. My friend and I decided to make an impromptu trip to McCarthy to surprise her father for Father's Day weekend. We got off work early that day and packed up her 1997 Isuzu Trooper. A little note about the Trooper, adventurous Alaskan girls don't always budget for practical things like new car tires. So this Trooper may have had its last road trip due on these tires. But we'd made the trip before and it was not going to be a big deal. We made it to Glen Allen, had the usual toke tie, topped off the tank of gas, and proceeded towards the McCarthy Road. Now, if you've never driven the McCarthy Road, especially prior to the most recent road improvements, it's about 60 miles long, mosquitoes the size of your fist. You rarely see other cars while you're driving the road. There's no cell service. And most important to note, it used to be an old railroad. So frequently, railroad ties and railroad spikes still come up out of the gravel. So we're headed down the McCarthy Road, and about 30 minutes in, we get a flat. No big deal, we were prepared. We had a full-size spare, swapped out the tire, and then headed back on our way. About 9:30 at night, flat number two happens. Flat number two was a little bit more complicated. We had a spare repair kit, but no air compressor. Luckily, we were about a mile from the bridge where a few RVs had pulled off for the night. So we took a walk down to the RVs and, by luck, managed to borrow an air compressor. By the time of night, the lucky, friendly RVers had loaned us the air compressor for the rest of the evening, and we made arrangements to meet them in McCarthy the next day to exchange it. So we headed back to the Trooper, fixed the tire, filled it up with air, and we were on our way. Our what was supposed to be leisurely seven-hour trip was now at about 8.5 hours, and we still had about 45 minutes to go. We joked about the irony of two flat tires and continued on our way. And then flat number three happened. Now, flat number three wasn't like flat number one, and it wasn't like flat number two. Flat number three, you could stick a couple fingers in. We were lucky enough to hit one of those great Alaska-McCarthy Road Railroad spikes. Luckily, I was traveling with Renee Welty, and this girl is as Alaskan as they come. Her purse is like the equivalent of Inspector Gadget's briefcase, except like Alaska girl style. So on any given day, you could reach into her purse and pull out a shaving razor, a go-girl, a change of underwear, some small airplane parts, some tools, and some nail polish. So I knew I was in good hands, but the mosquitoes were starting to swarm and the light was getting dim. So we started pulling things out of the back of the Trooper. We pulled out the spare tire, some snowboard boots, some ski skins, some NSYNC CDs, some random size 2x4s. And then we started compiling a list of things that you could put in a hole. We tried some rags, some paper towels, some gum, an old Clif Bar. And then we came across that spare glove compartment tampon that every girl has. We knew for sure those things could fill holes. So we unwrapped the tampon, discarded of the unneeded plastic applicator, and proceeded to insert the tampon into the tire hole, string side first. Once we got the tampon in the hole, we wanted to make sure that full capacity was filled, and we started to flare out the end of the tampon. To make sure it was at full expansion, we dropped a couple drips of water in there and watched it expand. That's what they do. So at that point, the hole looked filled. But we needed to seal the tampon to the tire. And luckily, kayak glue was something Renee had in her car. So we pulled out the kayak glue, proceeded to seal the tampon to the tire, and then soaked the remainder of the exposed tampon with kayak glue. And what better to seal a tampon to a tire than quick-drying, waterproof kayak glue? At that point, we were pretty sure the hole was filled, but neither Renee or I had any experience with how well a tampon could hold up being repeatedly beaten down a gravel road. So we did what every Alaskan does, and we threw some duct tape on there for cosmetic and protective purposes. We had that air compressor. We proceeded to fill the tire with air, and it held. At that point, we were about 45 minutes from her parents' house, and we took turns finishing the drive with one of us sitting in the back seat with our head hung out the window, because if all else failed, we were not going to miss an opportunity to see a tampon go shooting out of a tire across the McCarthy Road. By the grace of God, we rolled into her parents' house at about 1:30 in the morning. What I learned is that you don't roll into anyone's house in rural Alaska at 1:30 in the morning without being greeted with a rifle. So in absolute exhaustion, mosquito bites, and our arms waving in surrender, we exposed ourselves to her parents and made our way into their house. We got inside, explained what had happened with the car tires, and that we were happy to be there in surprise of Father's Day, and went to bed. And our unbelievable surprise, we woke up the next morning to 4 new tires and rims on her Isuzu Trooper in McCarthy. By luck, her dad had noticed the condition of her tires on his last visit into Anchorage and managed to find an unbeatable deal on Craigslist and picked up some tires and was planning to deliver them on his next trip into Anchorage. We needed those tires right then. Now, with a lot of fatherly, loving criticism, we definitely heard about the fact that we shouldn't have been on the road in those tires. But there was also a lot of pride in her dad's voice on our ability to fix this tire with on-the-fly ingenuity. In fact, on one of our last trips to McCarthy, we found that tire still proudly, but slightly hidden up against the wall in the garage with that tampon string still still proudly dangling from the inside of the tire in defeat of the McCarthy Road. Now, we've been called MacGyver's daughters, and we've heard things like 100-mile spare takes on 100-mile tampon. And we've heard things like, good thing you had a tampon for those tires. Yeah. But I tell you, it's not very often anymore that I take a long trip without making sure that my glove compartment is appropriately stocked.
That was Nicole Stemke, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about that is also on our site.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come, and I love your lips. What I give me some. Will we fuss and fight? Things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what movie we'll be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries, darling. I'll. No more reassuring. Things are looking up. You're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch. Who could ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what movie we'll be. We can swim on the sea.